In the news.
Hi there. I'm Professor Shaw.
I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Government.
Number five. So this will be our last In the News segment. So we got that going for us, which is nice. Other than that, geez, not much in the news this week, right? Just kind of a sleepy summer week going on. I guess we'll lead with the Supreme Court. So, Professor McDaniel, what happened last week?
So the Supreme Court made a number of key decisions, and we're not going to really go into those. You can read those because there are numerous decisions. We could spend hours talking about them. But really the big thing is that a justice is retiring. And so that is Justice Stephen Breyer.
Anthony Kennedy.
I'm sorry, I'm getting them all mixed up.
We're just waiting.
Yeah.
Vultures are circling for a few of them.
I'm sorry, Anthony Kennedy. And Kennedy is important because Kennedy was always seen as the swing vote in many ways. So if you think about the way in which the Supreme Court is set up, you have nine justices. And really, it's that fifth justice, the median justice, is the one who kind of sways things certain ways. And Kennedy is known really for his support for gay rights issues. And that's really one of the things where he's really stood out compared to others. Now, he was appointed under George H.W. Bush. And so in the late 80s, early 90s.
I thought Kennedy was a Reagan appointee. I think he might even go back that far. So going back to Reagan, I think.
Yeah. So he's a Republican appointee. However, he has been on the liberal side on a number of issues, specifically dealing with gay rights. Now, he has also been on the conservative side dealing with other issues. But this is really a big thing because he was the swing vote. So you're not getting somebody at the tail end. And so with the death of Justice Scalia and the appointment of Justice Gorsuch, it was basically trading conservative for a conservative. Here you have somebody who you might consider to be conservative on certain dimensions, liberal on other dimensions, but was kind of right there in the middle. And because of this, there's this concern that this may shift the way the court is going to look. And so there have been a lot of things, studies that have been done to say, okay, what will the court look like now with this new appointee coming in? Given the names that have been put forward, what will the court look like? What should we expect in terms of some of the decisions? Again, these 5-4 decisions. As Professor Shaw has pointed out in the lectures, most of the decisions made by the Supreme Court are either 9-0, 7-2. Like, they're overwhelming decisions. There are 5-4 decisions, and those are the ones we focus on. Now, these are rare, but these are also ones that are a little bit more, there's a little more conflict around those. And so it's going to be interesting to see how the court takes shape regarding these issues.
Yeah, we've got a visual aid to kind of demonstrate when Professor McDaniel and I talk about the ideological bent of the court. Now, this is something that's in your lecture slides, so this should be familiar. You know, we just came off of the modules where we were focusing on the institutions of American government. The Supreme Court is one of the big three, right? Congress, the presidency, and the court. By the way, we have to apologize. We try to keep all of our lectures really, really fresh, but my God, American politics moves quickly. So you'll notice in the Supreme Court slides, we haven't even updated with Gorsuch into the mix, let alone, you know, anticipated Kennedy's retirement. So let's go to that slide. We've got this on a tablet, and I wanted to show you guys this. This is something from Monkey Cage, which is a political, kind of a quantitative empirical blog run by the Washington Post. And kind of the overseer is a former colleague of Professor McDaniel and I, John Sides. John's a great guy, really good political scientist. So right now, you can see the current configuration of the court. Now, these aren't just made up. These point estimates here are derived from the voting patterns of the justices. Now, Professor McDaniel pointed out, and I think this is something that you really want to keep in mind, that Kennedy, as you see there, you've got on the right, the conservative wing, you've got Thomas is the furthest right, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and then Roberts, a little bit distance between Roberts and the others. Then you've got Kennedy. Then you go to the left, you've got Kagan, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Ginsburg, kind of, you know, in that order. So you see Kennedy, and you can see visually why so many people are really interested in this retirement and the subsequent appointment, because you got four liberal justices, four conservative justices, and Kennedy out there as kind of a swing vote. Now, Professor McDaniel and I, as I said, we were talking about this, and he said, look, Kennedy is... He ends up scoring kind of in the middle, but that reflects two different tendencies. He tends to vote with the conservatives on most issues, especially those involving kind of constructionism and liberty, sort of a libertarian view about limiting the government's role in society and the economy. But on social issues, he's tended to vote with the liberals, or at least been very amenable to the liberal position. And so if you're interested, like, why are the Democrats so fired up about this? The thinking is that the LGBTQ community, the pro-choice community think that Kennedy prevented the conservative wing of the court pushing the country's decision-making processes on these important cases further to the right. So they would prefer to see somebody, well, they prefer a liberal, but they certainly don't want to see Kennedy appointed by somebody they think that will put have sort of a conservative orientation towards some of these social issues. And of course, the big one everybody talks about is Roe v. Wade, the abortion case. I want to make a quick sort of nod to people or a quick sort of comment on Roe v. Wade. One of the things you got to recognize about Roe v. Wade, let's just say Donald Trump nominates a very conservative justice, and that justice joins a block of five that vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, by the way, I think all of those things are speculative at best. Is Trump really in a position to nominate a very conservative justice with a narrow majority in the Senate, right? Would that conservative justice actually vote conservatively on these issues? That's not a given. Kennedy was nominated by Ronald Reagan, ended up being a swing vote. John Roberts was nominated by George W. Bush, and he's been, a little less than reliable for the conservatives on some important cases. So I'm not sure that's going to happen. But if it does, you need to remember that the Roe v. Wade simply asserted that there was a constitutional right to choose, that it was part of this penumbra of rights under an assumption of privacy, and therefore the states could not pass any laws that infringed upon a woman's right to choose. Okay, so there's a fundamental right there. If the court were to overturn Roe v. Wade, that would simply mean that the states would be in a position, or the federal government could pass, Congress could pass a statute protecting rights to choose. You could have a constitutional amendment protecting that, the states would be. So for those of you, I'm not saying it's not something that you all ought to be concerned about. I'm just saying that there are a lot of steps between here and there. And even if Roe v. Wade were overturned, certainly a state like California, New York, other states would immediately step in and pass laws protecting a woman's right to choose. I think even states like Texas would. They would simply define it. So let's, bear that in mind, that all of this is part of a process, and that's a process Professor McDaniel and I have been emphasizing throughout the semester. These court cases are important, but sometimes the court, in the case of Roe v. Wade, what the court came in and did in Roe v. Wade was say, this right is in the Constitution, the government can't touch it, right? It's not subject to democratic deliberations and legislation and stuff like that. If you take away that protection, it doesn't necessarily mean that, abortion is going to be illegal. It simply means that states and the federal government would have to step in and define public policy in that area, right? So, consequential, but that's five or six steps down the road. Let's see what happens in the interim. Now, there is an interesting question. We don't want to spend too much time on this, but what we think President Trump's going to do with this nominee, and does he have the votes? Kind of quoting Hamilton, right? Do you have the votes on this? What do you think? Looking at your Professor McDaniel crystal ball, who are the key senators that you're going to be watching?
You have a number of senators. I think Senator Collins from Maine.
Right. She's Republican from Maine, right?
She's made it clear what she wants in terms of a Supreme Court justice,
and said
anybody who's anti-Roe v. Wade, she's going to oppose.
Right. She said she could not support somebody who opposed Roe v. Wade, which I thought was interesting.
And so,
all right. So if we go to this, let's see if we can get this up on the camera here. This is that same graph, and if you think of Senator Collins, who Professor McDaniel, there's no prompting here. He just said Senator Collins, but we happen to have a graph here. This is imposing Senator Collins' voting record on the same ideological spectrum as the justices, and you can see that Collins is actually to the left of Kennedy. She's a Republican senator from Maine, but she's to the left of Kennedy. So you know, if we were game theorists, we'd say she might oppose anybody, you know, to the right of her position. And she said Roe v. Wade is a litmus test. Who else do we have? Murkowski from Alaska.
Yes, because those, I mean,
both pro-choice Republicans. Right?
Yeah, these are two critical. I mean, again, two women in the GOP in the Senate who have played a key role in terms of the repeal of the ACA, a number of things where they have actually broken with party ranks, with the rank and file of the party, because they didn't like the way things were going down. And so it's going to be interesting to see how they play out in this, because, again, as Professor Shaw pointed out, it's a very slim majority, and you put somebody there that they don't like, it doesn't go through. And so you see this really becoming very dicey. And also with the midterms coming up, it gets even dicier than that.
Yeah. So let's just quickly, we'll say a few things and get out of this. The first is, you know, the president has the right to nominate, has the obligation, constitutional obligation, to nominate justices to the Supreme Court. The Senate has the right to confirm those nominees. That's the checks and balances we've talked about throughout the semester. You'll probably recall a couple years ago in 2016, when Justice Scalia passed away, actually out in Marfa on a hunting trip. This was in, I think, May, maybe June. And the Republicans, President Obama nominated somebody to the Supreme Court. The Republicans, who had a majority in the Senate, refused to give that nominee, Garland Merrick.
Yeah.
Garland Merrick? Merrick Garland. I always forget.
Merrick Garland.
And it's sort of a shame that could have been a chief, could have been a justice on the Supreme Court. Now we don't even remember which was his first and second name. They refused to give him a hearing. They Mitch McConnell in the Senate, the Republican leadership in the Senate, rolled the dice. They said, 6 months till the election, we should wait for the presidential election before we do this. And I say rolled the dice in the sense that Hillary Clinton was winning in all the polls. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. If Clinton had won, Clinton would have been in a position of either renominating Obama's choice or saying, no, I want my own, and substituting somebody who could have been much more liberal. You know, Garland was seen as being kind of a moderate, and Obama thought that it was kind of important not to nominate a very liberal justice and sort of cheese off the Republicans. It turned out it didn't matter. But that might have been the best the Republicans could have gotten under the circumstances, but they refused to go along, and they ended up winning the presidential election and getting Neil Gorsuch as a replacement. So the strategy paid off, but Democrats are still very angry over that. They think that was a stolen seat. Now, on the other hand, it was replacing a conservative with a conservative. So I'm not saying it was right or anything. I actually think it was a very dubious move. Now, Democrats are saying, like, well, there's another election, not a presidential election, but there's a midterm election. You know, the president's under investigation. So, you know, maybe we should just wait. And what their hope is, of course, is that if the Democrats win two seats and take back the Senate, then they'll have a slim majority and they can exert significantly more influence over who Trump nominates for that position. I don't think there's a single chance in the world the Republicans still control the Senate and the presidency. You can't, the rules have been changed in the Senate, so this isn't something you can filibuster anymore. You could filibuster for years, which meant that the majority had to have 60 votes to vote of cloture to end a filibuster. The Democrats, when they had the Senate and Republicans were blocking Obama's federal judicial court nominees, changed the rules. When they lost the Senate, this is the trouble when you change the rules. If you lose the majority, all of a sudden the other side inherits those rules. So the Republicans no longer require a supermajority in order to get their judicial nominees. All they need is a majority, but they barely got a majority. John McCain is ill, battling cancer, hasn't been voting. Right, so that's one perhaps lost vote. You got two, Murkowski and Collins, both pro-choice Republicans who face, you know, kind of maverick electorates in Maine and Alaska that aren't, you know, they're conservative, but they're kind of libertarian type conservatives. You may see Trump reach across the aisle for Democratic support. Joe Manchin, a conservative Democrat from West Virginia. Heitkamp, a conservative senator facing re-election, Democratic senator facing re-election in North Dakota, and also Joe Donnelly, Democratic senator from Indiana in a tough re-election fight. My sense is that if you can't get the Republicans, you're probably not going to get the Democrats. But those are five senators that y'all want to watch as this process unfolds. Trump has said he'll make his pick within a week. So next week at this time, I guess we'll have the pick and we'll know how the politics maybe is stacking up. But at any rate.
Yeah, so we know LeBron's going, and now we'll know
LeBron's
where the pick
going
is.
To my Lakers.
That's right.
To my Lakers. So Lakers be relevant again. Finally.
But one thing that is important about this, and I think this is something we need to remember, is these fights over the justices in many ways may hurt the court. And so whoever they appoint, because this can be the appointment is so highly politicized, it's going to be interesting how they behave once they get on the court, because if they see any of their decisions being highly political, that means the court may lose its legitimacy. Because again, when we talk about the Supreme Court is able to do things because people see it as legitimate and they respect the opinions. And so you may see a change in terms of the behavior of some of the members of the court in order for it to come off to look nonpartisan. And so again, anybody that's appointed, it's the expectation they will behave this way. However, where you stand depends on where you sit. I mean, where you sit depends on where you stand. Sorry about that. And so when they're on the court, they may be focused on maintaining the legitimacy of the court. And so because of that, they may make decisions that may be contrary to what people expect because they want to maintain legitimacy and the idea of fairness within the body. And so, again, the more politicized it becomes, the more you may see the court either reject certain cases or in many ways take stances that are very, very finely detailed and not making broad decisions because they do not want to seem partisan.
I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, this is sort of a personal prediction. If there is a very conservative justice nominated and voted for, confirmed by the Senate, I think John Roberts is going to slide to the left.
Yes.
I do. John Roberts has consistently shown he's interested in kind of protecting the prestige and the credibility and making sure the court is seen as non-political. Just for you guys' edification, if you're interested in kind of exploring this further, there's an interesting article on reforming the Supreme Court by Bob Bauer. Bob Bauer is a Democratic lawyer, attorney, kind of a real power broker in Washington. Very smart guy, was close to President Obama. Bauer wrote this interesting piece talking about reforming the Supreme Court. And he basically starts with the premise that the opposition, the way the Senate has evolved, the Senate has become very, you know, political in its consideration of these nominees. He goes, it's because the court has a lot of political power. You know, why deny it? Why pretend that the opposition to justices is based on some sort of interpretation of their judicial credentials? He goes, that's nonsense. We know it's nonsense. He says we should change, and he has a couple of proposals. One was interesting. He proposed an 18-year term to a Supreme Court justice, and he said this lifelong term, he said, is probably something that's outlived its usefulness. So let's move to a term-limited court, not a short term, a very long term, but so that they're replaced, so that you kind of know the cycle they're on, and can anticipate that. He's got a couple of interesting ideas like that. So if you're fired up about Supreme Courts and politics. Bob Bauer has a couple of interesting points on that. So,
yeah, and there's an article on Vox which talks about the idea of the swing voter and how that changes given the new appointments, things like that. I'll try to post that to the module.
Okay, cool. That's obviously the dominant issue in the news. We got a couple of other things we want to just address real briefly. We keep talking about immigration because immigration keeps dominating the headlines. If it weren't for the Supreme Court, immigration would have, you know, been kind of the headline in every In the News session we've done this time around. So we want to talk a little bit about immigration, a little bit about the election in Mexico. Just have a couple things to say about that, and then a couple local issues. So let's talk about immigration. I wanted to roll a little clip from CBS News talking about how this issue and how the executive order that the president issued has evolved. And then what seems to be sort of increasingly intense Democratic response to the situation on the border and the separation of families and this kind of thing. So if we could roll that clip from CBS, it set us up.
The debate over immigration continues with a growing number of Democrats calling to abolish immigration and customs enforcement. In a tweet Sunday, the president wrote, quote, "The liberal left, also known as the Democrats, want to get rid of ICE, who do a fantastic job and want open borders. Crime would be rampant and uncontrollable. This after protesters held rallies coast to coast Saturday against the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy. Here's what the president had to say about Democrats in a new interview aired Sunday on Fox News.
Between Maxine Waters and Nancy Pelosi and getting rid of ICE and having open borders, and the biggest thing, you have open borders, all it's going to do is lead to massive, massive crime. That's going to be their platform, open borders, which equals crime. I think they'll never win another election, so I'm actually quite happy about it.
It's worth noting Sunday's interview is one of more than two dozen the president has given to Fox News since taking office. In comparison, no other news outlet has been allowed to interview the president more than half a dozen times over the same period.
I love that little shot they get in on CBS News saying, it is worth noting. I don't know if it's worth noting. It's worth noting if you're CBS.
Yes,
but,
it is.
But the little shot about the president sort of favoring Fox News aside, interesting development. You know, you all know from previous conversations that we've had about the situation on the border, the separation of families. There's an interesting development now, and I think it's going to play out in the election. That is that Democratic opposition to the president's policy and kind of fervor over immigration generally has led to some fairly strong calls here. So ICE, for those of you who, you know, let's make sure that we're all clear on the terms, is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement. It is an agency. It is an agency under the Department of Homeland Security. So the development of ICE, or the kind of bureaucratic institutionalization of ICE, occurred when after 9/11, when Homeland Security was instituted by the Bush administration, and a lot of different government functions were kind of brought under Homeland Security. Now, what's kind of interesting, so what they're calling for, what a lot of people are calling for now, is the abolition of ICE. Now, this to me is a little curious, right? Because ICE is an enforcement agency. It strikes me, and this is, I'm sorry, a little bit of an editorial comment, that I think the problem that people have is probably more properly directed at the law itself and or the enforcement kind of entity. So ICE is an instrument that reflects the legislative mandate, right? That we have immigration laws, ICE is supposed to enforce them. And to the extent that there is flexibility or discretion with respect to enforcement, that comes from Homeland Security and the executive. So I find this kind of curious, and as someone who grew up in California, especially Southern California, it's interesting. I've been reading this stuff from people who are talking about ICE, and there's sort of this longing for the days of the INS, the Immigration Naturalization Service, which is what used to do what ICE does now. So prior to 2002, 2003, the INS enforced immigration policies. And there's all this stuff about how, oh, remember the days in the INS, and that was... INS was hated back in the day. I grew up in San Diego and went to school at UCLA, and I remember Cheech and Chong, this comedy team, you know, doing all these routines about INS agents, and the entire film Born in East LA, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend, but is an absolute shot satire of the INS. So I find this nostalgia for the INS, especially on the part of the left, kind of curious. But be that as it may, you know, there have been a couple of electoral stunners in the last few weeks. You know, the number four ranking Democrat in the House lost a primary to a 28-year-old who'd never run for political office before. But her platform, the winning candidate's platform, was essentially abolish ICE. Kamala Harris, kind of a long shot Democratic presidential potential candidate from California, has called for abolishing ICE. So this is something that progressives have sort of grabbed onto as a way to differentiate them from the establishment Democrats, who are more kind of, you know, cautious. And I think this thing has some real potential to, you know, be an issue within the Democratic Party. Both parties, by the way, have enormous conflicts and sort of coalitional tensions. So I don't mean to suggest that, you know, either side is a bunch of happy campers. But this one, I think, is yet to play out fully on the Democratic side.
Yeah, it's... In many ways, people talked about the rise of the Tea Party and the rise of President Trump as reactionary conservatism. You could argue that the rise of Bernie Sanders and many of these others is reactionary liberalism, where they're not pragmatic. They're doing it out of frustration and anger and taking positions that they they normally wouldn't take, but they're just trying. They're just extreme because they're upset about the way things are happening. One of the things that's important to note is the story about U.S. immigration is much more complex than the way we're putting it forward. A lot of people have argued that the changes in the immigration laws have actually made the undocumented problem worse. Because there used to be the Bracero program, it used to be ways to allow individuals to kind of cross the borders, work, and go back and forth with greater ease. And with the closing of the borders, now these individuals were basically came over and they couldn't go back. And so this has kind of created the problem. And so it's not as black and white as we try to make it out to be. It is very complex. It deals with the nature of the economy. And there are a number of things that we need to account for in doing this. And so I don't really think this idea of open borders, as President Trump talked about, is what the Democrats want. What you could argue is they want a little more of a sieve as opposed to everything being open, everything open, you have the wall. They probably want something more of a sieve where, you know, certain people can come back and forth, but certain people cannot. And this becomes a little bit more complex. And I think one of the greatest travesties that we've done is that our discussion of immigration policy and how immigration works has been so overly simplified that we fail to understand the nuance of it. And we immediately link immigration to crime, or that this immigration problem is something brand new, as opposed to understanding how the laws in the system may have contributed to the problem that we see right now.
Yeah, President Trump has repeatedly called on Congress to fix our, this is his quote, fix our broken immigration laws. And whatever you think about, you know, President Trump, I think there actually is a consensus that the immigration laws are in fairly significant need of reform. And so a lot of this, as we're talking about immigration throughout this summer, you know, a lot of it reflects the fact that Congress can't seem to get together to do anything. You know, there's agreement that there's a problem, but there's no real consensus on solution. The Republican majority in the House, actually the Republicans are a majority in the House, but it wasn't the majority that put this up. There was a Republican immigration reform bill that came up last week, and it was, you know, trounced. It lost like 390 votes to, you know, 140. It wasn't even close. So Congress seems to be in a position where they're not fixing the problems or addressing them. And Presidents Obama and Trump have, you know, basically used their discretion in interpreting the laws to try to shape and form policy. There's an argument that those efforts are not constitutional. I actually think that's probably correct in a strict sense. But, you know, Obama said, you know, well, if Congress won't act, I will. Trump has basically, you know, after saying he didn't have the right to issue an executive order, issued an executive order, you know, preventing the separation of. So, you know, all of this is, it's interesting. The issue itself is fascinating and complex and important, but it's a real interesting illustration of some of the problems we've got in our system. And Professor McDaniel and I, we like the country, right? We are advocates of, you know, the Constitution and the institutions that arise under the Constitution, but, you know, sometimes they just seem ill-equipped to deal with some of the problems, or maybe it's the parties or the individuals there are ill-equipped to deal with the problems that we face. Now, speaking of, right-wing populism in the form of President Trump, we had elections in Mexico this last week, and a left-wing populist won the election in Mexico. So Mexico now has a new president, Obrador, when he's sworn in. And we have a clip kind of talking a little bit about the election and Obrador's background that we'd like to show you and have a brief conversation about that.
Mexicans are celebrating what many are calling a revolution for this country. You see people pouring into the square behind me to celebrate an event they never thought would take place, the election of leftist populist candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's been running for president now for over a decade. This is his third attempt at the office. Previous attempts, he said, kept him from gaining office because of corruption. Not right now, though. He has more than defeated the opposition. That's because more of Mexican society, he's mainly appealed over the years to the nation's poorest. But this election, he managed to reach out so many people were struck by his anti-corruption message, his message up against the violence that is racking this country. But now the hard questions will begin to emerge. How will he govern? How will he, for example, confront Donald Trump over the issues that are so unpopular, like the wall, like the trade war? So those questions still remain, but Mexicans are out right now celebrating this very unlikely victory. Patrick Ottman, CNN, Mexico City.
Okay, so you see what's going on in Mexico. So, brief bit of context here. Mexico had was a one-party state for about 80 or 90 years. It was dominated by the PRI, the Partido Revolucionario, I don't know, Internacional, Industrial, I'm not sure, the PRI. And so they had one political party. They had elections, but the PRI won every election. Now that changed, in about 15, 20 years ago when a challenger party was kind of allowed to emerge, the PAN, the P-A-N, Partido Acción Nacional, right, the PAN. So there was the PRI, the kind of existing, bureaucratic party, and then the PAN, which was, kind of had various forms. There was sort of a free market element to the PAN, kind of a civil libertarian element to the PAN, and almost a kind of a social conservatism to the PAN. But it's sort of hard to describe in kind of left-right terms. There was the PRI and the PAN. Obrador comes from outside. So for several elections, you had something like two-party competition in Mexico. Well, Obrador comes from outside those two traditional parties. And as I mentioned, he ran in 2006, and there's a fairly considerable amount of evidence that his vote was basically suppressed, and that it wasn't really a free and fair election. I'm not an expert on Mexican elections, we say Professor Ken Green is and some others here. I don't know that there's a sense that Obrador really won that election, but there clearly is a sense that there was a lot of corruption and vote suppression going on there. But he became mayor of Mexico City, Obrador, and actually, even though his rhetoric is, and we say left-wing populist, what we mean is he's challenging corruption and the existing party, sort of a Bernie Sanders-type challenge, and he says that the entrenched interests are buying and selling the parties and the political system. He wants to open it up for more popular input, to redistribute the wealth in a little more equitable fashion. There's not much redistribution of wealth in Mexico right now. So in that sense, he looks a little more like Bernie Sanders than he does Donald Trump. But like Donald Trump, his appeal is to the sort of nationalist instinct, the sort of power of the people and the Mexican population, and everything that's part of the establishment is part of the problem. The United States is sort of a convenient punching bag, and Trump has certainly lent himself to that cause. So Obrador has used the United States and Trump and the wall as a rallying point for kind of the nationalism and the self-respect of the Mexican people. And that basically carried the day. So then the question becomes, and there's an irony here, right? You've got NAFTA, the trade agreement between the Canadians, the Americans, and the Mexicans, and you've got a left-wing populist in Mexico, a right-wing populist in the United States, and then kind of a center-left, prime minister in Canada. So what do we do? And Trump tweeted out, as he does, basically sort of congratulating Obrador, saying, I hope we can work together. I'm not an expert on Obrador, but I get the sense that he's a little more practical and maybe more of a realist than you might think, given some of his campaign rhetoric. Also, if he really wants to have a lot of spending programs and to redistribute the wealth in Mexico, he needs the United States to sign on and to sort of be involved in some of these infrastructure projects. So my sense is there may be more of a working relationship here than we would have thought. But anyway, I've sort of exhausted my expertise on Mexican elections. I don't know. What do you know?
One of the things to remember about populism is that populism can take a variety of forms. And the key aspect of populism is that there's this kind of noble masses and a corrupt elite. And so populism really splits the nation into between the noble, which is usually seen as the masses, and the corrupt elite. It could either take a liberal or it could take a conservative bent to it. And so if you think of Bernie Sanders, he was more of the liberal populism. If you think of Donald Trump, more conservative populism. But I think what also is important was what Professor Shaw pointed out about this nationalist aspect of it. One of the things that we see is if we compare the U.S. to other Western industrialized nations such as France, Germany, Great Britain, or the United Kingdom, that the U.S. is much more nationalistic, much more like to believe that people are more likely to say they're willing to die for the U.S. than people are willing to say they're die for the other nations. A sense of superiority, a sense that this is the best place to live. And what's interesting is if you compare the U.S. to Mexico, that the U.S. is really that Mexicans have this same level of national pride that Americans express. And so tapping into nationalism works in the U.S., but it also works in Mexico. And this idea of building the wall, I think can also helps this build this. But also this appeal to nationalism is something we're seeing happen really throughout the world. And so you're seeing this, the rise of nationalist parties. And we talk about nationalist parties. These are parties that really want to focus on really our nation becomes number one. Everybody else is an invader, and they are somehow going to taint the country. So we want to retain our purity. And we're seeing this happen all throughout Europe. We're seeing this happen in Mexico. We say it happened in the U.S. And much of this is a response to what we're seeing in terms of globalization with the change in the global economy. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this rise of nationalism takes shape and how this affects politics, but then also how it affects trade and things like that with other nations. Specifically, if this nationalism leads to another global recession, do we all of a sudden see that die out and really a new rise of globalization?
Okay, we're going to go local now, actually local and state. Yeah. Professor McDaniel dug up a story I thought was kind of interesting. You want to
All right.
Let us know what's going on with the bags.
All right. So those of you who are sick of paying 25 cents because you forgot to bring your bag to HEB, well, you may no longer have to do that. The Texas Supreme Court ruled that these plastic band bags are unconstitutional. And we actually have a video which talks about that a little bit more.
After 5 years without plastic bags in Austin, changes could be coming. Friday, the Texas Supreme Court ruled local government could not restrict the sale of containers or packages if not authorized by state law, meaning single-use plastic bags could come back to Austin.
This is, in fact, a broad-based bipartisan issue.
Environmental advocates are disappointed. They fought to ban the plastic bags for nearly a decade.
We canvassed on it. We spoke to tens of thousands of Austin residents. We generated thousands of letters to the city council on this.
Although the decision does not have an immediate impact, he worries the reversal will be detrimental to the environment and wildlife in the area.
When was the last time you saw the white plastic bag floating down the street in the city of Austin? It doesn't happen here. You go to Dallas, you go to Houston, and you see it again, you're like, that's right. That's something that we got rid of.
But not everyone is unhappy about the ruling.
That's a cost that that company has to bear just for that particular jurisdiction.
The Texas Retailers Association attempted to sue the city of Austin in 2013, but eventually dropped the suit. George Kellerman says this decision is a victory for retailers across the state.
This creates a level playing field, sort of a one-size-fits-all kind of proposal for the state as it relates to the regulation of packaging, not just simply plastic bags, but packaging in general.
For both ends of the spectrum, the impact of Friday's decision.
We'll certainly start to see over the next weeks and months how this is going to develop.
Likely won't be understood right away. Chelsea Trahan, Spectrum News.
And this really talks about a battle that's been pitted between environmentalists and business. To what degree do we protect the environment at the cost of business? What degree to protect business at the cost of the environment? Now, one of the things about it is the gentleman said, like, when's the last time you've seen a plastic bag? And so there's this argument that there are fewer plastic bags in the waterways, things of that nature. Austin, as basically saying, we believe that's the case because they don't keep track of these things. And so one of the problems we have is, has this ban really worked the way we want it to? And so we said we've talked to a bunch of people. Well, talking to a bunch of people is helpful, but we actually need a good objective measure of this, and that does not exist. And so we really don't know if this is effective as we believe it is, and it is interesting to see what will take shape as this goes forward. And again, the Attorney General has already sent a letter to Austin and several other cities that have these bag bans saying, look, you can no longer enforce this given the Supreme Court's ruling. Now, the city may try to fight this a little bit longer, but it looks like these bag bans really will not, may have a very short shelf life in the state of Texas, so to speak.
Just a couple quick comments. The first is it plays into this issue that Professor McDaniel and I will highlight when we talk about sort of Texas and reforming Texas government, that is the limited ordinance power that the localities that the city and county governments have in the state of Texas. This is something that a lot of people think there ought to be more of. That is that local communities ought to have more power. You shouldn't have to have state legislation to do certain things. But and I haven't seen the brief that the court considered here. It's not surprising to me, and it may not even be a tortured reading of the Texas Constitution to have ruled this way. The states and localities actually don't have a lot of power to do this kind of thing. And my guess is what the court said is that you do not have the ordinance power to do this. This requires state legislation. That's my guess as to what they...
Yeah, there was a law in the books. And so the law in the books is pretty clear that the low communities do not have the power to do this. So the only way to do this is to change the law at the state level.
Right. And so, you know, irrespective of what you think about the bag law, I think the court tends to rule on, you know, these sorts of narrow but important grounds. The other thing is that I think this is true with a lot of these environment business issues, is that it's become kind of a calling card. If you're doing business in Austin, and you emphasize that, oh, we don't do plastic bags, or, you know, we provide, cloth or other sorts of bags to help the environment, that when it becomes cost incentive for businesses to do this, they tend to do these things. So this isn't to say we shouldn't have environmental regulations or laws and that the market is self-regulating, but there is a market for this sort of, the guy was talking about presentation or packaging. There is a market for that. And in Austin, it's fairly acute. My guess is that, you will see plastic bags if this kind of moves forward. I'm out in Westlake and in Westlake Village, and at this point, they ask you if you want plastic bag. Do you want a plastic bag? And I don't think they offer paper anymore, but all sorts of people come in with their cloth bags, and there's cowboy bags and longhorn bags and stuff like that. So, it reminds me a little bit of the Kyoto Treaty that the United States withdrew from. The United States withdrawing from an international treaty on the environment doesn't mean the United States is then going to, get out the coal factories again and start polluting. I think we've kind of moved. Proponents would like to have formal regulation or bans in place to ensure that this happens, but I think there's a sense that we're moving in a particular direction. The question is, what's the role of the state in kind of regulating and setting those standards? So one last thing before we let you guys go. Today's the July 3rd. Tomorrow's July 4th. By the time this drops, hopefully you guys will see it on the 3rd, maybe on the 4th. But we wanted to go to the History Channel, one of our favorite sources for information on this, to give you just a little bit of a primer on the 4th of July to get you in the mood. So if we could roll that.
Every summer, Americans celebrate the anniversary of our nation's birth on July 4th, 1776. That's when the Continental Congress approved the Declaration of Independence, the revolutionary document in which the 13 American colonies announced they were free from British rule. But bet you didn't know, some people think we should actually celebrate on July 2nd, not the 4th. That was the day the delegates actually voted on the Declaration. They just didn't have the written document completed and printed until the 4th. Ready for some more 4th of July facts? Well, for starters, Philadelphia's famous Liberty Bell was not rung on July 4th, 1776. Its big moment came 4 days later, on July 8th, to honor the first public reading of the Declaration. No fewer than 3 presidents, all of them among the nation's founding fathers, died on Independence Day. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson died hours apart from each other on July 4th, 1826, 50 years after the nation declared its independence from Britain. James Monroe also died on July 4th, in 1831. From the beginning, Americans marked the birth of independence with parades, speeches, music, and public readings of the Declaration. Artillery salutes, a key feature of the earliest Independence Day celebrations, went out of fashion as cannons fell out of use by the late 19th century. But there's one early tradition that hasn't gone out of style. Fireworks. Congress first authorized pyrotechnics as part of 4th of July celebrations way back in 1777. Today, more than 14,000 fireworks displays go off across the nation every July 4th. The largest of these is the Macy's 4th of July Spectacular in New York City. Some 75,000 pounds of fireworks go off during the roughly half-hour show, which is attended by 2 million people. And since 1941, most Americans have gotten to enjoy a little relaxation with their fireworks. Congress made Independence Day a federal legal holiday that year. And we bet you didn't know, it's one of only four federal holidays, along with New Year's Day, Veterans Day, and Christmas, that are celebrated on the same calendar date each year.
All right, so have a happy and safe 4th, and hopefully keep it under 75,000 pounds of fireworks.
Do your best.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.